Podcasts of Homegrown are made possible thanks to support from listeners like you. Consider becoming a member of WFPL by calling 502-814-6565 or at the website wfpl.org. Thanks. Welcome back to Homegrown. I'm Janine Wishy.
I'm Bob Hill.
And today on the show, I suspect a beautiful fit.
Conceptually,
it's a beautiful fit, right? Yeah. Director General of the International Center for the Potato, Pamela Anderson. We'll talk about this a little bit, but Bob just got back from Peru. And then Stephen Bartlett, who's the Director of Sustainable Agriculture of Louisville, will come in and talk with us as well about his work with refugee families and local farming, sustainability issues, and then this new training session that they've got coming up. So international to right home to give us some real perspective.
Like I said, all politics and agriculture is local.
Yeah,
it really is.
Absolutely.
When you think about it, it really is, yeah.
Beautifully put.
And these are great programs, both of them. One in the Andes Mountains and one here in... Who knows, Louisville, Southern Indiana somewhere.
That's right.
We hope.
We hope, exactly. So, and it keeps building, to be sure. So, yes, Pamela Anderson will be joining us shortly via the telephone, of course, because she's in Peru.
Yeah.
And Stephen Bartlett will be in the studio. Bob, let's talk a little bit about your trip to Peru.
Well, thank you. Know how much time we have.
I know. The highlights only, sir.
It's the last time we'll leave you in charge of the weather. I know
okay.
that.
No kidding. Good grief.
It was 75 and 80 degrees down around Lima, Peru.
Freezing here.
Snow and ice, yeah. Mm-hmm. Had a great time. A Louisville couple named Trish and Jack Howard made the mistake of inviting me, mm-hmm. us really, mm-hmm. five of us to come down and visit them. And they live in San Bartolo, just south of Lima. Don't ever invite me to go anywhere because I'm
You'll
going.
You'll regret it.
We had a great time. Peru is an interesting place. It's a third world country in a lot of ways, and it's making progress in a lot of ways. But we didn't get to go to Machu Picchu, but we went around the Inca ruins, mm-hmm. In Cusco, and walked around those incredible terraces that were made 1,000 years ago, mm-hmm. and the irrigation with the Incas, and mm-hmm. the farming practices and the social structure, which we'll touch on in a later show. Just a fascinating place. The edge of the country is desert. Then you have the Andes, 12, 14, 18,000 feet tall. Mm-hmm. Then you have the Amazon, all in the same mm-hmm. country. Just a delicious trip. And
the highlands and the Andes, that's what they considered the highlands, right?
Right.
That's where the potato, crazy thousands of different varieties of potatoes have been grown.
There are literally thousands of them.
Yeah, okay.
As we'll talk about later, I saw hundreds of different varieties of potatoes, and there's thousands of them that they...
And colors, shapes, and
it's just
sizes.
Amazing. Yeah. They're like art in a lot of ways. Mm-hmm. And they store them all in a big basket, and they brought it out and let me see it and touch them, and it was very nice of them to do that. And, we had a great time.
Yeah.
It's just a great time. It's an eye-opener in a lot of ways, visiting, again, the third world, but you just learn.
Yeah. Great.
And you take nothing for granted.
That's right.
Nothing.
No, never. Well, we look forward to hearing more about your trip to Peru over the course of the next couple of weeks. Today it will be on potatoes. Bob, there's a couple of things going on around town. They also involve sustainability and food production. Probably one of the most well-known names in the movement, quite frankly, is Joel Salatin. And he's coming to Louisville on March 12th. There will be two opportunities to catch Joel Salatin. There's a lecture at 5:30 on March 12th at the Clifton Center on Payne Street in Louisville. And then following that, there's a dinner where there will also be a presentation. So you can go to one or the other or both. But, of course, there are different fees for either one. But it's going to be March 12th, 5:30 lecture, 6:30 dinner at the Clifton Center. You can go to our website for more information, or you can go to the Community Farm Alliance's website, which is communityfarmalliance.org. And you can purchase your tickets online and get more information.
Meanwhile, if you're feeling lucky, the Salato Wildlife Education Center has a $10,000 backyard makeover. It's a raffle. Cindy Sullivan will come out and redo your yard. There's some native plant experts. It'll be $8,000 or $10,000 worth of decks and lawn furniture and native plants and birdhouses. Whatever you want, you can go on our website about how to win a $10,000 backyard makeover and help the Salado Wildlife Education Center.
That's right. Goes to a good cause and you may actually win something after all. All right, Bob, back to the potato. I have ordered my potatoes. I should be planting my potatoes at any point now. Usually I manage to get them in the ground by mid-March, but of course that all depends on if the soil has dried out enough.
Yeah, this year especially.
My potato terraces aren't quite as well drained as the ones you'd likely find in the highlands of Peru.
No, they've been around for 8,000 years up there in the highlands. It's,
wow.
It's a great story, and we have a woman to tell us all about it. She's Pamela K. Anderson. She's the Director General of the International Potato Center at La Molina, Peru. Will explain to us about the history of the potato in South America and what they're doing to keep it going. Pamela, welcome to Homegrown.
Thank you very much. It's really a pleasure to be with you.
Yeah, now, the Potato Center is just one of the international food centers that were set up around the world dealing with different kind of crops. So give our listeners a sense of that first before we focus on the Potato Center.
Well, the system that I work within is called a Consultative Group for International Agricultural Research. We're 15 centers, and we've been set up over the last 40 to 50 years. It's actually a very interesting history. It began with some research in Mexico that was attempting to improve the maize production that was going on in Mexico. And I'm sure that many of the listeners have heard of Dr. Norman Borlaug, who was basically dispatched to Mexico to start looking at this problem. And as a result of the work that he did, he really started what we call today the Green Revolution. He developed a technological package that involved improved plant varieties, improved farming practices, and in maize, wheat, and rice, what we saw was a doubling to tripling of productivity of those basic grain crops in Latin America, in Asia, and in the Middle East.
Mm-hmm.
And because of that success, then there was a rapid coming together of many of the international donor agencies who deal with development, and they produced the funding to start setting up the system.
Mm-hmm.
And one by one brought in the other centers to create what is a portfolio of different commodity and thematic research areas that we need to deal with conserving the basic food crops and doing research to reduce hunger and poverty.
Mm-hmm. So is there a mission within that, or beyond that, I should say, Pamela, that addresses, you know, puts these crops, I guess, into a cultural context, do you know what I mean, relative to the way these crops had been grown? You know, when I think about the potato and the history of the potato and the thousands of different varieties, you know, are we looking at the way people used to do things, or are we really just looking forward into new technologies?
No, it's both. As the agenda of the centers has evolved over these 40 years, it became very, very apparent very quickly that we couldn't only be looking forward. And so if I go back to the example of the International Potato Center, SIP, one of the things that we have developed is a very close working program with communities in the highlands. So studying the history of the potato, the domestication, the evolution, as you say, the cultural contexts. We were one of the first centers to bring in anthropologists and sociologists as staff scientists to really put them in both historical context but also contemporary context.
Mm-hmm.
And really study food systems, if you will, and how potato is part of a broader food system.
Mm-hmm. Now, let's talk about the problem in general. We all know in the States, of course, the Irish potato famine and what that did to that country. Is that part of the reason you exist, to avoid that monoculture and to develop a more diverse potato crop around the world?
That's actually a lovely example, because the real problem with the Irish potato famine, everybody points their finger at potato late blight, the disease. And certainly that was the shock to the system. But the real problem was exactly what we were just talking about. It was the bigger context. It was the sole dependency on potatoes. It was the lack of appropriate policies. It was the other vulnerabilities, the lack of financial capital and social capital and mm-hmm. physical capital. And so when we look at the systems around the world, the developing world where we work, a lot of what we're looking at is vulnerabilities. How do we go in, because we have programs that don't just focus on the potato and the research at the field level, but at the systems level, at the landscape level, how do you go in and work with partners to transform what are vulnerable systems into more resilient systems. Mm-hmm. So that is really part of the contemporary research portfolio. Mm-hmm.
So can we talk about the Andean program then? Because it is, as you say, addressing diversity and, you know, not just one type of potato. Because, Pamela, let me ask you this first, actually. In the U.S., there's probably just a handful of different types of potatoes that are being grown, so the monoculture vulnerability is still there, I would suspect. And is the U.S. engaged in what you all are doing down there with an eye towards diversity?
The research objectives really in North America and Europe are quite different. It's changing a little bit, and it's being driven, from what I can tell down here, mm-hmm. From a health perspective as much as anything. People are quite interested in diversifying their diets, and so that's leading to diversification of some of the production systems. Mm-hmm. But
so
I agree, as an American, I can say and agree with you that I still think we have serious work to do mm-hmm. in North America and Europe mm-hmm. in terms of diversifying the production systems. Mm-hmm. What we have in the Andes is, if you take a look at the Andean chain from Venezuela down to northern Argentina, we find 5,000 varieties
wow.
of native potatoes mm-hmm. that are still being produced.
Mm-hmm.
And so you've got systems that continue to be highly diversified. It's nothing to go into the field of a small farmer in the high Andes and find 100 to 200 types of potatoes in their fields.
Mm-hmm. Pamela, what's the reasoning behind such 5,000 different varieties? Why is this area so diverse?
Well, first
naturally.
Of all, these people were master agronomists. I mean, one of the things that very few people realize, because we tend to take our food for granted, but if you go back historically and you say, where did these crops come from? We don't have a written language from pre-Columbian societies, with the exception of the Maya, and so you don't have the records to tell you that these people produced more domesticated crops for the world than any other region of the world.
Mm-hmm.
They were just master agronomists.
Mm-hmm.
The potatoes fit into that highland niche almost perfectly. And it was an area where the other native crops that we were seeing develop here, the maize and the beans, tomatoes, the peppers, really couldn't reach. So there was a unique need.
Mm-hmm.
And what happened after the first domestication event north of Lake Titicaca is that the domesticated potatoes started moving north and south, and then you had a natural process of interacting with the wild potato species
okay.
that were still there and still are there, and a continual selection process.
Mm-hmm.
They developed a lot of the variation, and you see this in other areas. When I worked in the Amazon of Ecuador with cassava, with the Quechua Indians, you saw similar kinds of diversity because the different potatoes or different cassava would be used for different functions. They also use the diversity, what we were just talking about, to manage vulnerability. It's their risk management portfolio.
Mm-hmm.
So if you plant out 100 potatoes and you have a bad year because there's an El Nino or a drought or a flood, some of those varieties will survive. And so you really won't collapse back into a mm-hmm. no-food scenario.
Right.
Yeah, Pamela, when I was down there a couple of weeks ago, I saw these bins of the amazing diversity of potatoes. But tell our listeners specifically, what's your research program is? What do you do with these potatoes, and how do you genetically change them or not, and then send them back up to the mountains again?
Right. SIP has the largest collection of potatoes and sweet potatoes in the world. We are what is called one of the in-trust collections. So we have a contract with the United Nations, and part of our job is to conserve these treasures. So part of the job is literally making sure that they continue to survive. So of those 5,000 varieties I was mentioning, we have about 4,200 here in the gene bank. And so we continue to protect those. It's basically holding them in trust for humanity.
Mm-hmm.
But it's not just a museum collection. We, as you say, use them. One of the uses is to make sure that the communities in the highlands that depend on them also have access to them, because those populations live in a very high-risk environment. They have floods, they have droughts, they have political unrest, and any of these root and tuber crops are not like corn or bean seeds. You can't put them in a little bag and store them. They're living organisms. So the seed of the potato is the actual living potato that you take from one season to the next. Mm-hmm. If they have an extreme event, either political or natural, they lose their potatoes. So in the last 5 years, we have repatriated about 25 to 30% of this entire collection here, back up to about 40 communities in the Andes that have had problems. So that's one of the things we do. Mm-hmm. And when we repatriate them back up to the highlands, we also clean them. Now, what does that mean? These crops will get infected by viruses, basically disease problems. And so one of the things we do is we regenerate them using virus-free methodologies, and we send them up potatoes that have no diseases in them, mm-hmm. or what we call clean potatoes. Mm-hmm. And you automatically boost the yields 30% when you do that. Mm-hmm. So they get their diversity back, and they get it cleaned up, so they get productivity boosts. The other thing that we do, because we actually work all around the world, we have staff members posted in 18 countries around the world, and we work in about 50 countries. And so part of the gene bank is utilized. We screen and study what's there. We look for specific special traits. It might be resistance to drought, resistance to high temperature, resistant to specific pests or diseases. And then we do what's called conventional breeding. We actually continue this process that these master agronomists started 8,000 years ago, and we continue to improve the potato so that it can withstand, you know, some of these biotic and abiotic stresses that it meets in the field.
Mm-hmm. You know, we can all kind of envision the traditional seed bank where seeds are dried and stored, and, you know, you had mentioned potatoes are completely different that way because they're a living organism. So how do you guys have your collection preserved?
Are they
freeze-dried?
Well, actually, that's the idea. What you do to protect a collection like this is mm-hmm. you set up a number of what we call lines of defense.
Okay.
And so we save them as tubers, as the actual potato that you would go and buy in the store, and you do that in essentially a big refrigerator.
Okay.
So it's you know, a cold room. And we have to plant out the entire collection every other year.
Okay, wow,
so,
that's labor intensive.
Yeah. So we have a field station up in the hills, and every year half of the collection goes up and we regenerate it up there.
Huh.
We've transformed the whole collection into what we call botanical seed, the true seed, and those are all kept in little aluminum vacuum packs,
mm-hmm.
Because also if we've got a disaster someplace, we can just take those out and mail them out. We
mm-hmm.
do quite a bit of crisis mitigation work when we're asked to. We are experimenting with what you call the deep freeze. It's called cryopreservation. And so we're looking on that as another preservation technique.
Wow.
And then we have what's called in vitro. You take test tubes, and you take the growing tip of the plant, and you put that into sterile medium, like agar, looks like, you know, clear jelly, mm-hmm. clear jello, and it grows there in sterile conditions, and that's another way of preserving it. And actually, that's how we clean up the different accessions from the viruses.
Mm-hmm.
We've got the biggest in vitro collection here of any crop in the world. So it's a number of lines of defense that allow us to really protect the crop.
And something else I learned down there was when you return these crops to the mountains and the natives, you're training the people and the farmers up there how to protect and save them at the same time.
We are, and it's a wonderful project, and it was their idea.
Mm-hmm.
They came to us in about 2004, and they said, we want to do this, and we want you to help us.
Mm-hmm.
And so we said yes, and we actually signed a formal agreement with them because that's what they asked for. And so what we are doing is working with the community and setting up rustic greenhouses or plastic houses and helping teach them how to select and reproduce the potatoes in a way that's more healthy. I've been up a couple times to see how the project is going, and one of the things they said to me goes back to a question you asked me earlier. I said, how's it going? Where do you see this going? What do you want to do with this project? And they said, and the answer wasn't about the biodiversity, because we've also sent up a large number of new accessions to them. But they said the real value of this project is it has given us back enough of our potato biodiversity that we can resurrect our rituals and our traditions and teach them to our children.
Mm-hmm. Wonderful.
So, yeah, it was. It gives me goosebumps every time I remember that.
You take control, again, on so many different levels when you can provide food for yourself. So has much of the agricultural knowledge been lost then, and people are just becoming engaged in it again, so they're seeking the information, the education?
Yes. Okay. It's hard to know how much, but from what I'm hearing, they are concerned. And they're concerned for good reasons. I mean, we all live in a world where we're being immersed very quickly in a different kind of technology, and the children are moving into the city centers, and so it's a question of how do we keep this alive? How do we keep the young people interested? How do we carry it forward? There's very interesting rituals that go with every part of the potato production season. Mm-hmm. When you're preparing the land, when you're planting, when the plant is flowering, when you're harvesting. And there is a dance, and there's a song, and there's a poem that goes with each stage. A lot of that's being lost. And so part of what they want to try to do is to maintain. It's not just food. Potato in this part of the world is also culture.
It's culture, absolutely, yeah. Yes.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Yeah. And so that's what they're trying to hold on to. Mm-hmm. And also what to me is equally important is one of the important traditions was the networks they had for exchange. Mm-hmm. I mean, any of us who have looked at the pre-Columbian literature know what the trade networks were like down here. But that included the potato. And this is important for them culturally. It's important for all of us because what we're seeing here with climate change is quite frightening. Mm-hmm. What we have maps of is how the potatoes, the native potatoes, have actually moved up in altitude over the last 20 years in response to the changing climate. And the real problem is that we have diseases, especially the late blight, which caused the Irish potato famine, that is also moving up. And our native potatoes are not resistant to that disease. Mm-hmm. And so it's frightening. And we've got to think very deeply about how to protect this biodiversity. So making sure that they have as much diversity as possible, making sure that they can access us to repatriate if they lose that, but also helping them resurrect their traditional exchange networks so that you get horizontal exchange amongst the communities in the Andes, I think is going to be a critical response to the climate change threats that's coming at us.
And Pamela, also the sweet potato is very important in your work. You've got like 8,000 different cultivars, that I understand. Talk about that a little bit.
Yes, we have the biggest collection of sweet potatoes in the world here at SIP, and we do the same kind of work with them, not in terms of the repatriation, because we don't have the same kind of well-defined, intense sort of center of origin and diversity. It's much more diverse. But we've got a fascinating program right now where we're taking the sweet potato that all of us know from growing up in the U.S.,
right,
which is orange, and we're moving it into Africa because the African and Asian sweet potatoes are white varieties. They don't have this wonderful beta-carotene, vitamin A, nutritious component. And so we've started a very large program in Africa called Vitamin A for Africa. It's orange flesh sweet potato, and it's basically to deal with food security, but also under 5 mortality and maternal mortality as you alleviate vitamin A deficiency. So it's another dimension of this kind of research for development.
Mm-hmm. Who funds all this work at the center?
Our center is funded by a portfolio of donors. The bulk of them are what we would call development agencies, for example, USAID, the United States Agency for International Development, and that type of agency in Canada, the U.S., Germany, U.K., Belgium, Spain, Sweden, Switzerland, Norway. I mean, most of the European and North American countries, Australia, New Zealand, so the developed countries. We have a number of foundations that also support us. We have a very, very important support from the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation on a large scale, especially for our Africa orange flesh sweet potato program. And some of the developing countries are beginning to invest seriously We have a brand new initiative, the BRIC countries, or what some people call the emerging countries, new initiatives with Brazil, and a brand new initiative with China. So it's really development funding, because the intent of the research is poverty and hunger alleviation.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's fascinating and encouraging stuff, and we sure appreciate your time.
Thank you so much, Pamela.
And thank you for your interest.
Pamela Anderson is director of the International Potato Center in La Molina, Peru. For more information on Pamela, the center, or to see pictures taken in Peru, visit the Homegrown page at WFPL.org.
Coming up after the break is Stephen Bartlett and Sustainable Agriculture of Louisville. You're listening to Homegrown on 89.3 WFPL. Welcome back to Homegrown. I'm Janine Wishy.
With Bob Hill.
And we go from an international potato center to something that's a little closer to home.
Like Louisville.
Like Louisville.
Right.
The ideas are the very same.
They are.
And I think it's a great juxtaposition of what we need to do sort of nationally and consider other cultures and other places. But in fact, we can do so many things at home that support the same ideas that bring it all together. And somebody that's been doing this for a very long time and very many different ways in our area is Stephen Bartlett. He's the founder and director of Sustainable Agriculture of Louisville. Stephen's long been involved in farm workers' rights and locally land access for refugees in terms of farming and urban agriculture. Sustainable Agriculture of Louisville is now launching a brand new training program for aspiring farmers. It's going to run from March through October this year, and we're going to find out a little more on that today. Stephen, welcome to Homegrown. Thanks for coming in.
Thanks for having me.
Sure. I think the last time we saw you was standing in the middle of a community garden in Crescent Hill. You had just gotten finished with a day teaching young gardeners, very young gardeners, how to garden. You prepared the food. Now you're taking that one step further, I think, because you're still looking towards young people, but it's training them to actually be farmers or urban agriculturists. Let's talk about what this new training program, I guess the motivation behind it, the thinking behind it, is all about to sort of hit the aspiring farmer.
Sure. Well, actually, some of our children who've been in the gardening camp will soon be looking for a vocation life. So
sure.
Part of our thinking was we really need to expand. And one of the bottlenecks for the local food movement, as Adam Barr, who's president of Sustainable Agriculture of Louisville, and I discussed a couple of years ago, is the loss of farmers and the loss of producers of food and the need for ways to bring more and more people back into food production. So that's kind of the strategic idea behind this training program.
Mm-hmm.
And they are young people, especially young in spirit. Not all of them are what we would consider young, but many of them are.
Yeah.
We have 15 people so far who are coming to a meeting this week and to be part of this training program starting in March.
Mm-hmm.
We're going to combine kind of seminar-style training with practicums throughout most of the growing season.
Mm-hmm.
So the trainees, after you know, learning and sharing about different aspects of soil fertility, business planning for farming,
mm-hmm.
what it takes to be a farmer, the decision to farm, what kind of lifestyle you need to have to be a farmer, some of these issues, we're going to be basically sending the trainees out to be mentored and to do volunteer work with farmers and with local organizations so they can get an idea of what it's going to take to rebuild a local food economy.
Mm-hmm. So do these folks have access to land themselves already? Are they already engaged in farming at all? Do you know what I mean? It's like, okay, it's one thing to know how to do it, but it's an altogether different thing to have access to the tools, if you will, that are necessary to accomplish a productive farm.
I think in the case of our prospective trainees, some have gardens.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think any of them have access to large amounts of land.
Mm-hmm.
So actually part of the training program, we're calling it an accompaniment, a commitment of our organization to accompany people after the training to acquire the means of production.
Mm-hmm.
And we don't know what challenges, I'm sure we can't even imagine some of the challenges we're going to see for getting access to a sufficient amount of land, water, seeds, tools. But that's the next challenge after people get a handle on sort of what it takes and they've met with and experienced local farmers who are making, eking a living out of direct marketing of their local production. Then the next step will be to look at creative ways to get the means of production. We've had some experience, you know, refugees, we've gotten some land for them, and we're looking for more land. A lot of people have land which they would prefer to lease out for actual production rather than just, let's say, having their pasture of hayed to have actual animals out in pasture, or to have their land used for production. And so we're seeing, we're thinking also a lot of churches have land that they might want to use in an economic development sense, that people can empower themselves by having access to land.
A community outreach sense, yeah.
Yeah, we recently, we had a whole crop grown out at Bethany United Church of Christ on Old Preston Highway that I helped match them up with the Somalian Bantu Association, and 12 families were able to grow crops, very good crops last summer. We had good rain and and produced a lot of the corn, beans, and vegetables and fruits that, that they've consumed most
that
of the year.
Family needs,
Stephen, are we talking some animals here too, some sheep and lambs and goats and so forth, as well as the root crops?
Yes, we're going to be looking at all aspects because, I mean, an integrated, diverse local farm system and even just a local farm really can make beneficial use of having a mixture of animals and crops for the fertility, integration of fertility into the farm.
How will these classrooms work specifically? I'm curious. These kids come in, they've never raised a lot of these things. How do you talk about that?
Well,
who
actually,
does it and how?
Yeah, most of the trainees are not actually kids. They're what I would say young adults or middle-aged people. And some of them are really strong gardeners who'd like to think about how to expand their production.
So they've got somewhat of a knowledge base, just not in the larger scale farming sense.
Right. So we're going to try to adapt and adapt the course, the content to the needs of the individual trainees. But a lot of them are interested in how to integrate animals and crops, how to do low cost soil improvement, improvement of fertility, that, those kinds of issues. And we're going to bring in, basically, we don't have any experts who know all these topics, but we're going to bring in the people who we know have that expertise to be part of this training program.
Well, you mentioned refugees from Africa and Asia and so forth. Does this work both ways? Are they going to teach you something about
it? Oh, I'll tell you. This past summer, I would come out to where we would pick up vegetables from the Asian and African farmers and then distribute some seeds. And we, of course, we use pretty much organic methods by providing compost and not using chemicals. But these farmers, you know, with just simple tools and a decent plot of land, were producing bumper crops of all kinds of vegetables. And we actually supplied quite a lot of the produce that Grasshoppers was providing to about 400 CSA shares this summer. And they're going to increase their purchasing of from the refugee farmers.
Now, what's Grasshoppers? I'm not sure what that is.
Grasshoppers is a farmer-owned local food broker, and they have their warehouse over in Portland. And they've built up quite a good market with restaurants, local area restaurants, and about 400 or 450 CSA. They even had a winter CSA this past winter.
And the CSA is where people will subscribe, like pay a certain fee, and then you get so much per week based on what's locally available, et cetera. So not so that we, because we're kind of going back and forth, but just to be a little bit more clear, there are two different programs that Sustainable Agriculture of Louisville is doing that we're kind of talking about together here. One is the training session, and this other involves the Refugee Agriculture Partnership Program, or RAP.
Well, actually, RAP is actually a program of the Kentucky Office of Refugees that I consult with.
That you consult with.
And I've also, you know, we've also been relating to some of the groups separate from that program to find more land access.
Yeah. Okay. So my question, I guess, that kind of mixes it all together again. With refugees that are in our community now, they come from places, they have a body of knowledge about their own agricultural practices. So can they, in fact, help us or provide a model for us in terms of sustainability in Louisville that will help us move forward as this movement moves forward? Because we've been so jaded by our contemporary agricultural systems.
Yes, actually, I'd say that's a very good point, because and it's why I'm so excited about working with the refugee farmers who mm-hmm. have so much, who come with so much knowledge and experience. In their own context, they were growing enough food, you know, for their families and to sell on a very low budget, low amount of investment, very simple tools. So, you know, they're capable of doing a low input production that it takes a lot of years to mm-hmm. learn how to do if you're just beginning. Mm-hmm. Some of them are realizing also with how hard it is to make a living as a farmer here mm-hmm. in the United States mm-hmm. is that it may be that they're going to have to band together. So we're already talking about cooperative cattle ranching, mm-hmm. and we're in the process of looking for some land for some Nepalese from Bhutan mm-hmm. who are experienced cattle people. And they, I mean, their picture is, oh, you find me a pasture, we'll build a little hut on it, mm-hmm. and we'll, you know, mm-hmm. just get us the land. For them, they see it real elementally, the land, and they know how to do it from there.
Right. You know, it's like, so whose doors are you knocking on to find land that can be used in this way?
It's kind of coming haphazardly to me. Mm-hmm. As people know the work we're doing, we have people who have land that want to make use of it in different ways from mm-hmm. how they're using it now.
Kind of grapevine.
And then I do some outreach. I do some networking with local churches and have discussions with congregations. Mm-hmm. So it's a variety of ways that we're using to get land.
So you're at the end of this thing, you're hopeful that they can make a full-time living as a farmer, or still, like many other farmers in Kentucky and Indiana, just kind of work part-time and do the land part-time?
Yeah, I think it's a continuum. I mean, as we know, even really smart farmers are having to supplement their income with second jobs. And I think that will be the case for some time. It may be that some of these cooperative efforts could become successful enough to provide a bulk of income for families mm-hmm. over time. You know.
How does the output fit into our contemporary system of distribution and consumption as well? Mm-hmm. So like whatever they produce, how do we get it into the market in a reasonable sort of way?
Yes, my colleague who's working with the refugees, Lauren Goldberg, and I, we just had a field trip out to some local ethnic food stores and with the refugee farmers to mm-hmm. have a look at how food is displayed, how it's marketed, what the prices are for some of the exotics that they want to produce. This year, I've ordered a lot of seeds of exotic Asian and African mm-hmm. vegetables, and it's an experiment to see how they do in this climate. Mm-hmm. Things like the bitter gourd and all kinds of vegetable, the greens and snake gourd and other kinds of crops that are very popular in Asia and also among Asians living here. So there's a good market for a lot of these products. But for our aspiring farmers, a lot of the training is going to be looking at how it is that people are surviving with the direct marketing type of...
Okay, so direct marketing too. So you've asked the grocery stores what they would want to carry, so you'll grow it and hopefully directly supply these particular ethnic markets.
Yeah, it's an ongoing process. Okay. I mean, some of the small groceries, we've been supplying some food to some of the African food shops, mm-hmm. and I think it's going to expand. It's only the mm-hmm. third year for the refugee program, mm-hmm. so we've overcome a lot of the initial learning curve for dealing with this climate.
Sure. What works and what doesn't. Are there farm markets, too, that can support this, just traditional farmers markets like we have all around town?
Yes, in fact, we were marketing at two farmers markets with the refugee farmers. Mm-hmm. And so I got to know a lot about the different farmers markets and applied, for posts in different markets. And there's a lot of opportunity for people who have produce here locally to get into farmers markets. You're going to have to invest a lot of time and not make a lot of money at the beginning, but a lot of these farmers markets keep growing and becoming more profitable over time.
Now, Stephen, when it comes to processing the meat and the chickens and so forth, will they do it themselves or go through traditional processing, butchering outlets?
I don't know how to answer that exactly, but I mean, part of our training is going to be on what's expected, what are the norms and regulations in terms of...
Sure.
Right.
So a lot of, the farmers I work with, like Adam Barr, he has local processors who butcher it according to, USDA mm-hmm. certification. Mm-hmm. So we're going to have to go that way. Of course, people who have their traditional... They just want to distribute meat among their family mm-hmm. for rituals like goats mm-hmm. and things like that. Mm-hmm. Obviously, they know how to do that.
What do you think is the value of these things when it comes to maintaining cultural continuity, cultural pride, you know, the finding a new place in a new country, that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm. Well, to me, culture is a subset of agriculture. So, I mean, I think a lot of our cultural heritage comes from our relationship to the land, and I think we need to strengthen that. And that's part of, I mean, part of training people to be farmers is also thinking about a different way of thinking and living, because once you're related to land, it's not just a linear process. This is a whole integrated process of finding how your life fits with the land and with your society. So we view it as a very fundamental process of restoring our relationship to the land. And for me, I mean, community life is so much enriched once you have that relationship with the land, and then you recreate or restore old rituals, you know, the harvest rituals, the planting rituals. I think U.S. people are really hungry for an integrated view of their relationship with land, and I think that's going to be part of this local food movement, is restoring a kind of ritualistic and sacred view of what our relationship is with the earth.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Another question we asked Pamela, actually, the funding of all this, where does the money come from? Is there an umbrella group helping you out here?
Actually, I was going to ask you for a donation.
No. Checks in the mail.
No, we're asking a fee for the trainees for this program, but we're also, it won't cover all of our staffing needs, so we're in the process of fundraising with individual donors, and also looking for other sources of funding that may be in the offing.
In-kind donations as well.
That's right.
60 acres close in, perhaps.
Right. I mean, one of the projects kind of that we're really excited to think about for the long term for Louisville is creating a kind of urban intervale. Intervale is an experience up in Burlington, Vermont, where they have like 300-acre composting and budding farmer. They have 10-acre slots for farmers there. We're thinking...
So community garden on steroids, basically. Instead of a little plot, you get
exactly
10
a big,
acres.
A big training center here in Louisville. We're looking around, and we'd like to eventually make a partnership with many other organizations and think about, you know, a serious urban ag training center where people can learn right here in the city, where they can get collective use of tools and resources and that kind of thing. So
wow. So just one real quick, like it's not a real quick answer, I'm sure.
Semi quick.
But you have been involved in all of this stuff for a really long time, Stephen. You know, from Immokalee workers to stuff at home, and you travel all kinds of places. You just recently got back from Haiti. Do you see us making progress in Louisville?
I think the amount of awareness and the consciousness has been raised to a large degree in the last 10 years. I feel like we're on a wave heading upward. And I feel like as people really understand what the harm has been done by corporate control of agriculture and our disconnect, I think people are really, they're beginning to get it conceptually. And the challenge will be taking that concept and putting it into real action and real work. And that's where you have to rely on kind of a campesino look view of things, a peasant outlook, which says, you know what, our bodies are made for working with the land, and actually restoring that direct connection. I think that's part of it. But I'm very optimistic, actually. Wherever I've traveled, and you all through Latin America, Africa, people all over the world are in this struggle, and there's progress being made locally everywhere.
Okay. Yeah. Great. Good. Thank you so much.
Absolutely.
It's
Thank you.
Always a pleasure. Thank you.
Oh, you're welcome.
Stephen Bartlett is the Director of Sustainable Agriculture of Louisville. They're launching a new training program for aspiring farmers and urban agriculturists that will run March through October of this year. There are a few slots still open. You can see our website at wfpl.org for more information on how to enroll.
Coming up, a few listener questions and another chapter in Bob's Fabulous Plant Stories. You're listening to Homegrown on 89.3 WFPL.
Welcome back to Homegrown. I'm Janine Wishing.
I'm Bob Hill with a question for you that
All right.
we get quite a bit, and it always raises your ire.
It does.
Your red hair gets flamed.
It does.
With reason.
It does.
Here's the question.
All right.
Denise Cross from Finchville. I just got my first fertilizing of my lawn completed by my lawn care service provider before all the snow.
And we've had, what, two or three rounds of snow, huh?
Is this okay even when the ground is frozen, or was he too early? The type he put down was 4600, as in a whole lot of nitrogen and nothing else.
That's right.
Thanks. Looking forward to your reply. Go get him, girl.
Okay. I say it's too early.
Yes.
And it's too early for a couple of different reasons. The thing that gets my ear the most is the fact that these are the sorts of practices that contribute to water pollution more than anything else.
Well, I'm with you.
Depending on where you are, I suppose. As that snow melts, so does all the urea in that 4600.
Yeah.
And when you have, typically when you have 46 nitrogen, it usually is urea. It's usually not a slow release as such. It's a faster sort of release.
I'm your choir kid.
So I'm glad I have your support, Bob.
Preach to me, baby.
It's a fast release. So essentially, and the fact that the ground was frozen, essentially all of that washed away into the closest path of least resistance into our waterways. Really, the recommendation is to fertilize your lawn in the fall of the year. Mm-hmm. And then if you must, which I don't think people must ever.
A qualified must from Miss Wishy here.
Well, you know, AJ Powell, our favorite agronomist, you know, that he's like, okay, if you must fertilize in the spring, wait until like mid or later in May after that first big flush of growth has occurred. Because, you know, the grass grows so fast in April anyway. Do you know what I mean? So you're really just feeding it to spend all of its energy right then. So if you do it in the fall of the year, you're much better off in terms of strengthening your lawn. And you won't be as likely to pollute our waterways in the time.
I hear you.
So there you have it.
If you have a question for Miss Wishy that will not raise her ire, or Bob even, visit the Homegrown page at WFPL.org. Email us at homegrown@wfpl.org or call us at 502-814-8246.
All right, Bob, I want to see how much you have, how much I have actually rubbed off on you, because I am banking on some sort of Peruvian influence with the word story
you
today.
You called up Janet this morning.
I'm just saying, don't disappoint me, babe.
Somehow. Okay.
It's got to be influenced.
Alstroemeria.
Okay.
Which is what?
It's the, actually, I only know it as Alstroemeria, quite
frankly. The Peruvian lily.
Oh, that's right, but I only really always refer to it as Alstroemeria.
I need a new partner. Right, I've got wishyitis now.
Okay, all right.
Matching up. God help me, wishyitis. I love the plant. I really do. You see it as a cut flower a lot.
Exactly.
You see it at weddings and parties and other less happy occasions, actually. Mm-hmm. It's got really cool slender rhizomes with roots kind of like a dahlia. Here's the neat part. The leaves twist in a funny way, so what looks like the upper leaf surface is actually the lower leaf surface.
Huh.
Did you ever notice that?
No, I didn't.
Well, you should have.
I've never really looked that closely.
I've had pretty good luck with them. They need a lot of sun and good drainage. I'm disappointed, however, in how it was named. I was thinking Alstroemeria would be something like astronauts or some glorious show in the heavens.
Mm-hmm.
No.
Not even close.
Named for some Swedish guy named Baron Claes von Alstromer, who was a plant and seed collector, and he sent Linnaeus some seeds back in 1753. And he named his beautiful...
So it's named after a person, not
Claes von Alstromer. It doesn't work, man. But the flowers are showy. You've seen it. I just love the thing.
And they come in so many different colors.
Yeah,
and
there's 50 species, 190 cultivars.
Wow.
More and more lately. And the reputation's borderline hardy here, but I've had good luck with it, like I said.
So in a warm, protected area.
Yeah.
Because isn't there a stone wall behind where you have yours planted?
Well, you remember everything. Sweet Laura.
Mm-hmm.
That's who she is.
Okay.
There's a variegated form of Sweet Laura called... Glory of the Andes.
Mm,
I gotta have that.
You gotta have that.
Comes with a poem.
Okay.
When it comes to a flower that's all frilly-dilly, nothing quite says it like the Peruvian lily. It's lovely and gorgeous and has me bemused. Why, even its leaves are slightly confused. twisted in a way in which upwards is down, but saved by its petals which glow all around. A name for a Swede, a good friend of Linnaeus, Baron Claus von Alstermer, the plant books all tell us. But I would have been much happier by far if only that queen had been named for a star.
Hmm. But Peruvian lily is a pretty good moniker, don't you think?
This show works.
All right, it'll work with another show too here pretty soon. All right, Bob, that was a good one.
All right.
Well, that ends another edition of Homegrown. Next week on the show, we're going to take a look at some of the Theodore Klein Plant Awards. When Dunwell will join us.
Homegrown is produced by the starry-eyed Brad Yost. In the studios of WFPL, I'm Bob Hill.
And I'm Janine Wishy. Join us next week for Homegrown on WFPL.